Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say you liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. State Representative Jessie Rodriguez is serving her seventh term in the Wisconsin legislature in the 21st Assembly District. She serves on the Joint Committee on Finance, and she's had a significant impact on getting this year's budget passed. But there's so much I want to talk to you about, Jessie. First of all, you were born in El Salvador.
Yes, I was born in El Salvador. I actually wasn't born in this country. So I came to the United States when I was 7 years old. My parents decided to relocate to the United States. And initially, they decided to live in Massachusetts. And that's actually where I grew up until I was 16 years old. And at that point, my parents decided to relocate again. And we came to Wisconsin. The funny thing was that we didn't have a lot of family in Massachusetts. And typically, when people immigrate to another country, they go wherever their family is located. So we did have a few cousins in Massachusetts, but the bulk of my family was in Wisconsin. So there was a recession in the mid-90s, and my father, who was a welder, lost his job, and he was the breadwinner of our family. And so family here in Wisconsin said, come to Milwaukee. There's jobs here. We'll help you find a job. And so after completing my freshman year in high school, we came to Wisconsin.
I want to back up. Mm-hmm. To El Salvador.
Sure.
Because that country has an interesting history.
Yeah.
And they had a 12-year civil war.
Yes.
You were living there then.
Yes. I was a child. Obviously, I was very young when the war started. It was in 1980. So I was probably 3 years old when it started. I was not aware of that. I was too young to understand what was going on around me. I have memories of people in my neighborhood, you know, in the evenings, getting together and kind of chatting with the neighbors, trying to figure out what was going on. Because at that time, there were curfews, and then they would turn all the energy out. So people were in the dark, and you know, the way they lit their homes was with candles. And so people would go, you know, everyone in the neighborhood that I lived in knew each other. They were like friends, and they would get together in the evenings and talk and try to find out what was going on, what they were hearing. And the kids would play while the parents were talking. And so I remember very fondly those evenings playing hide and seek with my friends in the neighborhood.
It was a violent civil war, though.
Yes.
I mean, there were, what, 75,000 people who died, about 10,000 that just disappeared. And a lot of people would remember Archbishop Romero
mm-hmm.
and how he was killed by death squads.
That's right.
While he was saying Mass
mm-hmm.
and the murder of the American missionaries and things like that. Did you hear much about that? As you said, you were a child.
Mm-hmm.
But were you or your parents aware of how violent things were at that time?
Oh, definitely. They didn't talk to me about it. I was too young to know what was going on. I knew that there was a conflict, but that's all I understood as a child. But they did know, and they were concerned. And one of the things that I think was the reason why my father decided to move to the United States is because in those times during the war, they would follow people, and they would see where people were traveling. We lived in a town called Puerto El Triunfo. It's a port town, and most of my dad's family were in a rural area, maybe an hour or two away from the port town. And he would go visit his family there. Well, because he was going back and forth, he got stopped and asked, why are you traveling? What is going on? And so, you know, in those days, it was not uncommon for people to make claims and accuse people of doing things. It may not have been founded, but as a result of that, people disappeared. People died in the middle of the night, and families weren't able to find them. So my father was concerned for his safety.
Was it difficult for your family to get out of El Salvador?
What I remember is that it was difficult in the sense that we were leaving family behind. And that I do remember. Parents didn't really talk to me much about it. All that I remember as a child was that they said that we would go to a new country, that it would be better for all of us. And so I saw wherever we were going to go as a place that was going to be better than where we were at. And that's how I envisioned it. I was too young to know exactly what that would look like, but it sounded like a great place because that's what my parents told me it was going to be.
Did
you speak English?
I did not. My parents did not speak English at all.
So that had to be hard when you first started school.
Yes. The irony of coming to the United States was that even though it was supposed to be a better land for us, a better place that I thought we were going to, the irony of it was that my parents were more closed. They didn't know a lot of people around us, so we didn't have the neighbors that we used to when, you know, I was growing up. They, you know, make sure that they were always watchful of us. They didn't want us to get hurt. And so there wasn't a lot of trust of the people around us that we lived in because they were all strangers. We didn't know them. And so I find the interesting thing is that I felt like I had more freedom as a child in El Salvador, even though there was a horrible war going on. And I come to the United States and it's a more sheltered, very small family that I did have there. And I had a hard time with that change, not having a lot of people around that I could talk to. And then the language barrier was another thing that was difficult. I didn't know the language. They held me back a year, actually, as a result of that. So I was behind in school. But one thing, and if you learn any immigrant story, whether you talk about the Germans, Italians, Polish, you find out that kids are the first ones who learn the language and adapt most than adults do. And that was the case for me as well. So I learned the language at a young age. I was the interpreter for the family. So I remember as a child, my mom would say, well, the electric bill came. I think they got how much we owe wrong. Can you call them? And I found myself not knowing what to say, but I had to help in some way or another. So I would get on the phone and would talk to someone on the other end of the phone and try to explain why we were calling. So at a young age, I think I learned to become more independent. I learned to believe in myself because I was tasked to do things that a child typically doesn't get tasked to do, but I was asked to do that to be able to help my family.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations,
you realize there's a process. You have to work with other people to get legislation supported in both houses and then hopefully get the support of the governor.
State Representative Jesse Rodriguez talks about her experiences being a freshman legislator.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with State Representative Jesse Rodriguez. Did that instill in you a feeling that you wanted to get involved in politics and in what was going on in society?
The interesting thing is, no. When I was a young child, what I aspired to the most was to go to university. That was my long goal, like my big goal in life. And I would tell my mom and my dad, I want to go to university. It was something that none of my family had ever done, you know, and we were immigrants to this country. And everyone knows that going to universities are expensive. And we were very poor, like most immigrants to this country. So I found it interesting some years later as an adult talking to my mom about my aspirations to go to the university. And she said, you know what, when you used to tell me that you wanted to go to the university, I didn't discourage you, but in the back of my mind, I thought, she's never going to go there. We don't have the money to do that. But she never discouraged me. And it's so funny that she encouraged me, and I was a good student. And as a result of my grades, I was able to get to the university.
What did you study?
So I went to Marquette University, graduated with a double major in communications and also Spanish.
Did you have goals at that time? Did you think of what you wanted to do once you graduated?
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to work in business. So my first job out of college was as a assistant buyer for a local grocery retail company. So, you know, when it came to politics, that was not something that I aspired to. However, my work after I had my child working for a nonprofit introduced me to the political sector. And that's how I started getting more involved in understanding the political world.
What made you decide I'm going to run for office? Because this is your first office, is it not?
This is my first office. I had never run for office before. And like I said, and that's not something I aspire to. But my representative at that time decided to retire early. And my husband actually sat me down and asked if I would consider running for office. He and his cousin had talked about it. And they thought with me working for the nonprofit, building relationships with people in the political arena, with people in the community of Milwaukee, that maybe that'd be something that I should try to pursue and at least consider. That's kind of how I got my introduction to that. It's interesting because I found out after I was elected that many women, at least at that that time, and this was about a decade ago, one thing that we had in common was that many of them were asked to run for office, and they decided to consider it. And I think one thing I've noticed this right now, a decade later, is that you're hearing less of women being asked, and actually women are actually taking the initiative and thinking, maybe I should run because I don't like what's happening around me.
Once you were elected and you entered the assembly, was it what you expected it to be?
I didn't know. I had an idea based on my conversations that I had with some of the people who worked in the legislature, but it was completely different. There was a lot of things to learn that I didn't know. You think when you go in that you're going to make huge changes right away, and then you realize there's a process that you have to work with other people to get, you know, legislation supported in both houses, and then hopefully get the support of the governor to do that. So I think people don't realize how much work goes into trying to make laws and change laws. And that's something that was a learning experience for me.
Was it difficult? Because I'm sure in the back of your mind, you thought, I'm going to go to the assembly and I'm going to get this done. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you realized, oh, maybe not so much.
That's right. That is challenging. I think it's challenging for any new freshman legislator, realizing that there are a lot of rules, there are a lot of discussion. And even though we come to the legislature thinking we have a great idea that everyone should be on board, then we realize as we discuss with other members that maybe that idea just doesn't resonate in other parts of the state. And as a result of that, you're not going to get the support. So I think you realize that it requires a lot more dialogue than you expect.
How did you end up on the Joint Committee for Finance?
So I had been serving several years as the chair of the law committee, family law committee. And I thought, you know what, I think it's time for me to do something more in the financial area and try to be more involved in that. And I asked my leader to appoint me. I was fortunate that he was very much interested in appointing me. And then I got support from other members as well. So that's how I ended up on the Joint Committee on Finance. I've learned a lot. It's a different type of work. When you are a chair of a committee or when you are a member in the legislature, you work on bills, you craft bills. That's mostly the focus of your work. When you are on Joint Finances, you learn how government works, how we pay the bills, why we pay the bills, why we are spending money on different programs and different policies. So it's a different take on government.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
Sometimes that one member will do a good job of making a case for why their idea is a good idea.
State Representative Jessie Rodriguez says a lot of the pressure she receives isn't from her constituents, but from other legislators.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with State Representative Jessie Rodriguez. What surprised you most?
Oh my God, how much I did not know. That's what surprised me most. Because we are so focused, like I said, in creating laws and, you know, kind of solving problems. When you are on Joint Finance, you get to learn more about the programs we have in place, why we have them in place, and why they're a good idea. So there's a lot more research involved with that, and there's a lot more reading involved in that. Then after that, in order to pass a budget, we need to dialogue with all the other members to get support.
How overwhelming is it when you're told we need a new budget and you've got to go through everything point by point by point?
Fortunately, I have staff to help me. It's daunting. It's a lot of reading. My day, I would say, my week during the Joint Finance budget discussions typically is reading all week. They give us binders of all the papers we have to read, policy ideas we have to consider, and then after that, we need to discuss that with the members. So even though we are the member that sits on Joint Finance, we have to work at least on the assembly side of the Joint Finance in the Republican caucus. So every member is tasked with dialoguing with other members of the caucus, keeping them informed on what issues we're thinking of, we're working on, what issues we need to consider funding, and then giving them the information and getting input from them. So it is very much a collaborative process. And the reason we do that is, one, we want to make sure that all the members know what we are considering, you know, what's on the budget bill, what the public wants, and then obviously understanding what the members believe we should do. So there is a lot more dialogue involved in that as a result. And I find that it's in the sense we're doing that, but we're also at the same time learning information as we read all the papers. And then we are constantly dialoguing with our Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which are basically the lawyers who do a lot of the number crunching for us. And they have a lot of data and information for us. So whenever we have questions, we reach out to them.
Is there a lot of pressure, though, when another member is advocating for something and really pushing hard? How do you respond to that?
When one member is pushing really hard, then you have to also find out what the other members, how the other members feel about it. Sometimes that one member will do a good job of making a case for why their idea is a good idea. And that can, in turn, bring more support from the rest of the members. If we see that happening, then we typically try to look to see if maybe that is something we should try to address. And usually it's a problem that a member is trying to solve. So I would say an example of this would be the work that I did this session on increasing the number of assistant district attorneys throughout the state. There were several legislators who wanted us to look at increasing the number of assistant district attorneys throughout the state. So we have 72 counties, and then there are in those counties district attorneys. We within the district attorney's office, they have assistant district attorneys who help the district attorney with their cases. One thing that I heard from a couple of legislators was that in their counties, there weren't enough assistant district attorneys to process enough of the cases. And as a result, there was a backlog. And so although that wasn't something we were thinking of doing and trying to address, as we heard those legislators saying, this is something that's important to our community. And if you look into it, you'll see that in other parts of the state, this is a problem. So what I did is I sat down with the State Association for the District Attorneys, and I had a dialogue with them and also the State Public Defenders Association to try to find out, you know, how bad the problem was. And as a result of those conversations, it became clear that, yeah, we needed to try to address that issue to increase the number of assistant district attorneys and also staff at the State Public Defenders also. So that was as a result of two members saying, this is something that's important. It's important to my community, but I think this is more widespread. It's an issue around the state. And as a result of that, I looked into it. My leaders looked into it as well. And then we were able to decide, as we saw more members, you know, supporting that idea, that we needed to do something about it.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
We still don't have all the information that is still being compiled right now, but that is something that we're going to definitely look at.
State Representative Jesse Rodriguez talks about the potential impact of that big, beautiful bill on the state of Wisconsin.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is State Representative Jesse Rodriguez. When you have an issue like that, where obviously you're going to need to allocate more money than you originally thought, how do you balance that? Mm-hmm. Does the money have to come from something else then to go to an issue like you just described?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that is something that we're constantly looking at. The difficulty this budget cycle was that we didn't actually know what the right figures were that we were going to have for to spend in this budget cycle. So when the governor introduced his budget in February, we believed there was $4 billion in money that we called it a surplus money, money that wasn't spent from last budget. And then we believe there are around $2 to $3 billion that we know could be ongoing money for the state. So we thought of it as two buckets. One that is a one-time money that we typically, when we have one-time money, we decide to pay for things or have it go to programs for a one-time cost. But anything that's ongoing, a program that we want to create, that we want to continue to pay and fund in the future, that we usually take from the ongoing revenue that we get. As we got closer to the discussions on the budget, and that was more closer to April and May, it became clear based on information that Legislative Fiscal Bureau gave gave us it was that we really didn't have a lot of ongoing money. We had the $4 billion in one-time surplus money, but we really didn't have the other $2 to $3 billion that we thought ongoing money. And the reason for that was because we found out as they did the number crunching and looking at the financials is that the cost to Medicaid for seniors had gone up. And as a result of that, there was something, an expense that we did not know was going to occur. But then they found out we needed to pay for that. So that meant that that money that we expected to have for ongoing was basically spent. So as a result of that, it was difficult to try to find ways to pay for programs that we currently have, but also for new projects or new programs or one-time programs. And I think that's why this budget cycle was way more difficult and more complicated because we had less money. Everyone thought we had more money and people were coming to my office and all the legislators advocating for a program that is good for our state, not realizing we didn't have the money to be able to spend on those programs.
How is the Big Beautiful Bill going to affect the budget in Wisconsin? Because obviously there are going to be some federal funds that in the past you could count on that aren't going to be there.
Yes, and we don't know yet. So those, I know that Legislative Fiscal Bureau is working with the Department of Health Services to try to figure out what the impact of the One Big Beautiful Bill will have on our state. One thing that we do know is that there is a belief that that One Big Beautiful Bill may not have as deep of an impact here in Wisconsin as it does to other states. And the reason being is because Wisconsin never expanded Medicaid. So a lot of the cuts that you're hearing, it seems that it will affect those states that did expand it. So we still don't have all the information that is still being compiled right now, but that is something that we're going to definitely look at. But we do believe it will have an impact. We just don't know how much, but we don't believe it's going to be as deep of an impact as in other states.
You've got access to all the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Is Wisconsin healthy financially?
Yes, we have a balanced budget. We've been balancing our budget every budget cycle. We have a rainy day fund, we call it. So whenever, you know, there's a downturn in the economy, we know we have that money sitting there that could help us. So financially, we're doing great. The other thing that improves our credit rating, according to Fiscal Bureau, was that we've been able to pay for our road projects or any, you know, we call them verticals or horizontals. So buildings or roads, we've been able to pay that with surplus money. So, you know, paying our debt down, which in turn helps with our credit rating. So we do have a very good credit rating in the state of Wisconsin.
There are always unexpected things. We saw it with the flooding here in southeastern Wisconsin. How was your district affected by that, by the way?
Luckily, not too badly. We had obviously some roads that were flooded. Some people had, you know, incidences of flooding in their basements, but not to the extent that we heard of in Milwaukee, in the city.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
Parents feel it's important. We hear it from our schools. We hear it from parents.
State Representative Jesse Rodriguez talks about what's good and what's not so great with our educational system.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is State Representative Jesse Rodriguez. One other question I wanted to ask you, because in your district, you were redistricted not too long ago, but you made it through.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What are your feelings as you're watching what's going on in Texas and California? And there seems to be an ongoing redistricting battle that could move to other states as well. Is somebody who made it through, how do you look at that?
I think in this state, we obviously worked with both houses, the Assembly and the Senate, and we decided to adopt the governor's redistricting bill that created our redistricting map. So typically, our constitution essentially says it's up to the legislature to craft the redistricting maps. Even though in that case, when we passed it, it was approved by the legislature and then it went on to the governor to sign it. So I don't think that there are going to be any issues in our state. I don't see that being the case. It's interesting to see what's going on in other states. But I think at our end, we've done what, according to the law, we should be doing.
Aren't Republicans and Democrats getting along well in the Assembly?
There are some policies, I think, that we will never agree on, but yet we find areas that we can find common ground. And I think the fact that our leaders were able to work together with the governor, who happens to be a Democrat, and on this budget shows that we are able to do that. So there were a lot of people who were not happy with us working together and passing a bill. There were a lot of people who were very happy. There were a lot of people who wanted us to do more. But that's part of a compromise. You know, working together means that not everyone gets everything that they want. They get something. And ultimately, I believe we passed a bill that will help everyone. We're providing tax cuts. The governor came along with us on that, providing an income tax cut for middle class families, for, you know, seniors, too. So seniors can now, if they have any retirement income that is through a 401k or a pension, they will not have to pay taxes on that, which is really good things. Then also, we eliminated the tax on fuel and gas and electric bills. The governor wanted to spend more on education, and we ended up doing that. We found ways that we could agree on. We had agreement on special education. And so we ended up working together on some areas that we had agreement on. I know that, you know, some of the advocates, especially in the schools, who advocated for more funding for special education, but we still did more this time around than we've ever done in the past. And the governor was willing to come with us too on that and agree with us as well. So there was a lot of, you know, discussion back and forth, and we finally landed on a place where everyone felt comfortable, the members of the legislature and also the governor signing into law.
And I know you've been very vocal on funding for education. Mm-hmm. What do you think the state is doing right, and what are they doing wrong right now?
We've been continuing to increase funding for education every cycle that I've been in on Joint Finance. That's been something that we feel is important. Parents feel it's important. We hear it, you know, when we go back home, we hear it from our schools, we hear it from parents. And so that's why over, I would say, around 60% of our budget, our state budget, goes on education, whether it be K-12, Yard Tech, you know, UW, all of that. So it is important. So we listen to them, and we're going to continue to do that. I think the biggest thing that is a struggle and an issue for all of us is the governor's 400-year veto, which essentially does not take any consideration on whether or not we have the funding to be able to pay for that sort of spending. And unfortunately, that ultimately ends up on the local property taxpayers' bill to fund. In our state, you know, we've tried to commit to two-thirds funding, so two-thirds of the funding for education to be made by the state, a third by the locals through property taxes. With what he did, it makes it very difficult to be able to adhere to that in the future.
You've been an advocate for parental choice.
Yes.
In education. Is that going to save us money? In the long run?
It is saving us money because the cost to send children to a choice school is less. The reimbursement from the state is less than what it costs to send our children to a public school. But I think it goes beyond the finances. For me, it's always about making sure that we have different educational options for parents and children that better addresses their personal interests and needs. And that's always been the reason why I have supported, educational options. So when people ask me, they assume that I'm just for school choice or the choice program or just the charter program. But I honestly do support public schools. And that's why, you know, I continue to support increasing funding to public schools. My child goes to a public school. I think if you find a school that's best, that meets all the needs of your child, where he or she thrives, then that's the goal of every parent. And so we shouldn't make it difficult for parents to have those choices.
I saw one of your votes had to do with teaching civics. Why did you make that vote? Why did you decide that is important in the schools in Wisconsin?
It's clear that a lot of people don't understand how government works. And I think, you know, that's something that should be introduced at a young level, at least in K through 12, to know how our government works, how our laws are created, who, you know, has the responsibility of creating laws, what the role of the executive is. How are we going to expect people to know how to vote and who to vote for if they don't understand how government works? Some people think that it's the executive who has all the power. The executive does have power, but the laws are created at the legislative level. And people have concerns with the courts. Well, legislators don't have the power of the courts. It's a different, you know, body. So I think people understanding, you know, how government works and what role each entity has is important in helping to educate voters and have a better understanding of what they're voting for and how they should vote.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
We know that our population is declining here in Wisconsin, but also nationwide. People are feeling financially stable that they are starting businesses. However, they can't find people to hire.
State Representative Jesse Rodriguez talks about how her personal story as an immigrant impacts her work.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with State Representative Jesse Rodriguez. We talked about your immigrant story.
Mm-hmm.
And I have such respect for someone who started out where you did, not knowing the language, the culture, having to be there for your parents to help teach them things that you were learning. It's got to be difficult watching what's going on with immigration right now.
It is. The issue with immigration is a problem that, unfortunately, our country hasn't tried enough to address. We know that our population is declining here in Wisconsin, but also nationwide. We are not having as many babies as they did in the past. And yet there is a concern by those who have companies who are creating businesses that there's just not enough individuals to be able to hire to do the work that they need them to do. So there's this dilemma, this problem of, great, people are feeling financially stable that they are starting businesses. However, they can't find people to hire. And then we have a population decrease. In the past, I've always been supportive of our country, finding ways to allow people to come to the United States through with visas to work. And unfortunately, our country hasn't done enough of doing that. And a lot of people have decided to do, you know, come to this country in a different way, which is, you know, illegally. I don't fault people for trying to do that. I know that when people are desperate, they do things believing that they're going to do something better for themselves and their family. However, it puts them in a situation where they become prey for to people who are willing to use them, to human traffic them, and use them for other ways. And so there is a lot of danger coming in that way. I'm just sad that our country is focusing more on only on the border and not addressing the other issue, which is how do we allow more people to come to this country legally and allow them to work in our country, knowing that we have, you know, a need for more bodies. So it's a tough discussion, and I think our federal government is trying to address it, but they're only addressing one part of the problem.
Well, in Wisconsin, I mean, this state was built on immigrants and immigrant labor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and I think that's probably going to continue, but I think our federal government needs to do a better job of trying to allow people to come here legally, go through the whole process of coming here legally, knowing that there is a need.
There's going to be a governor's race very shortly, and it's getting kind of crowded already, especially on the Democratic side. How do you view that right now?
Well, it's too early to say, but it's interesting to see more and more people on the Democrat side looking to run. So I think they'll have a very crowded primary. We'll see who ends up being, you know, on the top. On the Republican side, I know there are some people who have already announced and trying to get support, but there are still some other people that we haven't heard from who are, I've heard, are contemplating but haven't decided. So we'll see what happens. It will be quite interesting to see.
Would your role in the assembly be easier with a Republican governor?
Probably. I mean, it's still challenging because I actually represent a Dem district. So my district is 53% Democrat. So I am what you consider a swing district. So yeah, as a Republican, yeah, there are obviously policies that we agree on and that I would agree with, you know, a Republican governor. But I know also have to consider what my constituency wants and what they how they feel that we should solve a problem. So that is always going to be challenging no matter who the governor is, because I, you know, at the end of the day, I have to go back home and, you know, make sure that I understand what the needs of my district are and try to address those.
As a Republican who's won a Democratic district, that's going to make you pretty attractive to the powers that be that that, boy, Jesse Rodriguez might be a good candidate to run for another office, maybe a statewide office or congressional office. Is that anything you've thought about?
I really have not. I mostly focus on my district. And I know that as you go higher in office, that means you are spending less time at home. And right now I have a 15-year-old and he is starting his sophomore year this year. So he's got two more years and we'll see what happens next. If he decides to stay home and go to school close by, or if he decides to leave and go to a university farther away. But I want to spend as much time as possible with him. And I know that the higher in office that you go, the more responsibilities you have and the less time you get to spend at home and with your family.
You think he'll go into politics?
My son?
Yeah.
Well, he has a lot of opinions, so we'll see.
State Representative Jesse Rodriguez, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Libby.
We've been talking with State Representative Jesse Rodriguez. She revealed how she was born in El Salvador and some of the struggles that she and her family went through when they first came to the United States. She also talks about her work in the state legislature and how difficult it is to get a state budget passed. Now, if you joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Representative Rodriguez, go to WTMJ.com and share today's show with your friends and family. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.